goes inside of the picture. No, you have to take your mind off and babble and commerce and praise and that sort of thing. But even there, you see, the general education ought to help very much because of the discipline and the training that the mind has had in achieving that high standard of general education. Mm-hmm. If you are an expert, you might possibly be lopsided and not be able to take a broad outlook. But you may not be a good commercial man in charge of cement corporation or that. But a chairman of a cement corporation with his experts before him might be a general citizen.
With reference to the structure of the civil service as in the 1950s, I want to raise a few questions, particularly because you were in the Treasury. Didn't you feel that there was insufficient administrative integration? Say each ministry had several departments under it, and both recruitment, salary scales, and so forth in each of these departments was on a compartmentalized basis. Say under agriculture.
No, certainly not about that bit. The higher people were transferable. What do you mean?
Say in a ministry X, Land Development Department of Irrigation, Department of Land Development. Each recruited people in its own sort of had different methods of recruitment. Then say a class.
No, but they are all. They were all under the Public Service Commission. The schemes of recruitment are written by the permanent secretary of that ministry and sent on to the Public Service Commission, which approves or amends the proposed scheme.
Yes, but wasn't the scheme for the irrigation department different from the scheme for, say, the land department?
Naturally, for those technical officers, it must be different. You see, you can't have an irrigation engineer and a land development officer of the same type.
Yes, but what about the salary scale for just the clerks and peons in that ministry?
They are all under the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury.
Yes, but didn't it vary from department to department quite often?
Salary scales of peons and, I don't think so, they are clerical servants. Mm-hmm. General clerical officers. They can do clerical service.
Then at a higher level, I'm interested in the coordination of policy, say, a ministry. Then you get a permanent secretary in that ministry. But yet, quite often the minister deals directly with the heads of technical departments, like, say, the general manager railway.
Yeah, they function as assistant secretaries, practically, for their own respective jobs. You see? But the danger was this. The ministry office had a number of junior civil servants as assistant secretaries. So if the minister had no direct touch with the head of a department, or if the head of a department was of a too diffident a character, you see, to approach the minister direct, you see, and decided to do everything on paper. You see, those papers filter through the ministry office, and the assistant secretaries sit upon them, you see, exercise their own judgment and put up the minutes. So that delayed coordination, sometimes misled, misguided policies were taken, or there was obstruction.
But wouldn't it have been better to have minister and then the permanent secretary and under him all these technical people?
Of course they are all under him. He is the permanent secretary. He is under, has the constitutional function of general supervision over the departments in his ministry. But it's constitution.
But isn't there, hasn't it been a practice for general manager railways to go to the minister direct quite often?
As I say, he can go direct, but it is the minister's duty to consult the permanent secretary. There have been instances where, when I was permanent secretary, the Minister of Agriculture and Lands have gone direct to Mr. C. P. De Silva, who was director of land development and so on. You see? And sometimes the permanent secretary does not know, you see, what decisions have been taken at that level. You see, and in consequence, the result, sometimes occurs friction. You see, so, but if the rules of the game are observed all the time, all the individuals concerned, that is, the general manager of railways, you like to put that in?
No, sir.
General manager of railways, you see, to the going direct to the minister, and then, you see, at the minister's instance, and then the minister calls up the permanent secretary and says, well, this is the position, this man says this, what do you say? You see, then things would be all right. But if the head of the department wants to steal a march on the permanent secretary, for instance, you see, it all depends upon how these institutions are operated. Not so much the fault of the institution as the fault of the person who manning those institutions.
Do you think it's essential that the permanent secretary should be the minister's choice?
Generally, he is consulted by the prime minister. It used to be so. I believe it is so even now. Would you like to have him? Please have him. That sort of conversation takes place. You see, I want to change the other minister wants a change in his ministry. This chap is pretty senior, we will consult him. You take him. And that sort of attitude is the prime minister does not ordinarily impose his choice upon ministers in a well-ordered constitution.
Looking back, I was wondering whether our political leaders have realized the importance of the administrative machinery and for intelligent allocation of ministries. For instance, you know, sometimes the combination of departments in a ministry is not the rational and best combination.
I see your point. I mean, sometimes ministries are created under pressure from supporters, because you want to find the places for certain senior politicians, perhaps, who are pressing their claims for ministerial appointments. In such a case, difficulties arise. Like everything else, if everybody works disinterestedly and with a single-minded devotion to the country, things would be much happier. Everybody would be happier. We progress fast.
What about the question of overstaffing, taking the public service as a whole? Hasn't it been rather overstaffed, especially at the lower level?
I have heard it said so. What I cannot understand is that giving jobs to a few individuals under pressure from certain other individuals, you see, without there being sufficient work for these new job seekers. What I cannot understand is how that can help every politician to get enough votes to carry him through the next election. But there seems to be an idea that if anybody presses a minister or another politician for a job, he should be yield to that pressure in the hope that that recruit and his friends and relations and a whole multitude of electors will vote for him. I mean, it's all wrong. I don't believe that ever happens, but the psychology is difficult to understand.
And again, then, when you look at the salary scale, it has foreigners in particular point to the fact that at the top level, you get salaries which are much, much higher than at the sort of lower levels. That is to say that there is a big gap between salary scales at the top grade and the lower grade. Say between the clerks on the one hand and the executive officers.
If there is such a gap, it ought to be breached, I'm sure. There should be a smooth progression upwards, like our income tax, for instance.
But isn't it possible to use the income tax to bring, shall I say, more equalization of income levels?
How do you mean the tax progression?
Yes.
Well, that's what we have recommended in our taxation report. We have a smoother progression.
Then again, with regard to disciplinary procedures, have you ever felt that they were rather too slow and cumbersome?
It certainly is. There is no doubt about it. You see, now tell us. Let me see what the position is. The head of the department is given authority to dismiss persons at below a certain level. But he must interdict certain persons above that level, certain officers, and the whole inquiry, and then report to the permanent secretary. Then the permanent secretary, you, I don't believe he does it personally, but one of his assistants looks through the papers and then reports to the Public Service Commission, which in its turn appoints another tribunal to look into it. The procedure is certainly cumbersome and dilatory.
Do you think that has led officers to neglect punishing people where they might otherwise have taken steps to enforce discipline?
I suppose there is a tendency to take the easier course. You see, I certainly think that that procedure can be simplified.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't mean you must fire at once. A person hired, hiring, firing, has in a mercantile office. Even that is now hedged in by these labor and industrial relations.
I was wondering whether in Ceylon there has been a reluctance on the part of officers to discipline their subordinates on the theory that if we do so, his family will suffer, and considerations.
Very few are the senior officers are deterred by the family considerations. They are more deterred by what might happen at political levels. You see, that is what.
Turning to some different theatre, is it all right?
Yes. Okay.
When you were secretary to the cabinet, I was wondering what Mr. D.S.N. Nayak's attitude was with regard to the way cabinet meetings should be handled and the office organized.
Well, he wrote the Constitution and he left the secretary to follow the Constitution. In other words, it's the secretary who consults the Prime Minister and arranges the agenda. You see, the memoranda and so on. And it is the secretary who, in consultation with the Prime Minister, convenes meetings.
I was wondering whether he was particularly concerned that the right sort of traditions should be established.
Right traditions? Oh, yes. Even all for right traditions. He did not want any leakages from cabinet surface. I doubt whether there was anything very serious in his pain.
Mm-hmm. What about?
He didn't want decisions talked about until it reaches the administrator who's got to implement it.
Did he lecture to the other ministers on this at their, say, the first meeting?
Well, he just spoke to them. I won't say lecture, but at the same time, he got notes drafted with his hand, suggesting parallel procedure and the highest traditions of the British cabinet system, and issued them.
What about collective responsibility? I was thinking in particular of Mr. Sundaralingam's dismissal. Was that on that principle that he...
if you go on speaking out of turn, you see, against the conclusion reached by the cabinet, you render yourself liable to dismissal and require a little courage to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The acts. A good Prime Minister must wield a butcher's axe at times.
Did he, if I may ask, did he have any trouble at all with Mr. Bandhanayak?
Mr. Bandhanayak, I must say, was also scrupulous to observe the best traditions of that stage, even later, I should say. And I don't think he ever transgressed, you see, cabinet principles of secrecy His trouble with Mr. Bandhanayak arose on different grounds, you see.
Didn't Sir John in particular tend to bait Mr. Bandhanayak even at cabinet meetings?
How do you mean bait?
Well, to make remarks which would get under his skin.
Cabinet ministers are free to discuss, and in the course of discussion they might make very violent and even rude remarks. I mean, that's all in the game.
It was taken in stride, was it, generally?
It should be. I don't know. I mean, there are occasions when discussions get so heated, I suppose, that even physical violence is threatened.
Well, there's a very amusing story about D.S. on one particular issue. He, apparently all the ministers present were against him, you see, and he even took a vote. But he said aye and they said no, it may have been vice versa. And he was so big, and he said that if they had reconsidered that decision by the next day or something, he would resign or something like that. I don't know whether this is true.
Well, I cannot recall any such instance.
Mm-hmm.
See?
I think even maybe the story runs, he was the only I, and all said no, and he said the I's have it. But this may be a...
No. So long as I was secretary in the cabinet, there was no question of putting to the vote eyes or nose. You see, they generally got the sense of the house, of the cabinet.
Were you in confusion sometimes as to what decision had been taken? Because...
Yeah, of course. Because sometimes there are lots of loose ends which have got to be tied up. And that has got to be discussed post-cabinet meeting.
Because presumably you had to write the minutes and
right.
And sometimes everyone might talk and they said, all right, it's agreed, and you might be left wondering what the agreement was.
Yes, in which case it's my duty, I suppose, to get it clarified first with the Prime Minister and then with the ministers concerned, the leaders of the various schools of thought.
Weren't you in a somewhat peculiar position because you were also Deputy Secretary to the Treasury at that time.
At the start, yes.
So if there was a conflict between, say, Minister A and the Treasury, wouldn't you have been in a rather sort of peculiar position, or could you have expressed the
view? There can be no conflict between the minister, and the Treasury. There can be a conflict between the minister and the Minister of Finance. You see, the Treasury as such is merely an official body advising the Minister of Finance. It is the minister's responsibility. You see, there can be no conflict between the Treasury and the Treasury might advise the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Finance might adopt it. If in the discussion the Minister of Finance is told, no good, you are not giving me enough money for my program, there can be an argument, but the decision rests with the Cabinet.
Looking back on the Treasury as it was organized in the early 50s when you went in, would you say that, what would you say, was there room for improvement or were there any special shortcomings at that stage?
There's always room for improvement in every institution, Mr. Roberts. There was quite a lot of room for improvement, but to what extent that the improvement could be effected depends upon the people in power.
Now, I was wondering if there were any particular points that you recall, and as going in, well, as a new bloom, say, you felt that certain things should be done.
Well, organization and methods, we got to know them, the division to advise us. And there was a considerable advantage in the Treasury being represented in the position of a secretary to the Cabinet. There was considerable advantage because most of the proposals made by ministers have financial implications and they have been examined in the Treasury, and that point of view is presented with the observations of the Minister of Finance to the Cabinet. And the Minister of Finance has this gentleman from the Treasury at hand to consult him as to any defects in the memorandum or in the observations.
Was the Treasury, I presume the Treasury was consulted on the rice subsidy?
1953, 52, the Central Bank was the financial advisor. You see, the Central Bank was always for gradual removal of the subsidy, not an altogether absolute immediate removal.
I was not thinking of the removal of the subsidy, the decision somewhere around 50-51 to have this high subsidy. How did that come about, the decision to subsidize price?
Well, it was considered necessary at the time, I suppose.
Now, I was wondering whether you were consulted on that.
Well, I may have expressed opinion, but it wasn't in 1951, it was earlier than actually.
I think the rationing war years, but they sort of extended it around...
So, the war was over in 45, Mr. Roberts.
Yes, 45, but as far as I understand it, somewhere around 50-51, they took the step of higher subsidy. I was wondering what issues had influenced them at that time.
What is meant by higher subsidy? I mean,
to raise the support they were giving to the rice industry. Guaranteed prices plus...
Guaranteed price? Yes, it does. Taken on, 10 rupee figure was suggested, accepted. But that I'm not quite sure as to how. As far as I recollect, when I went in there, it was there. That is December 15th.
I know that you were under the orders of the Minister of Finance. But now looking back on UNP financial policies in the 50s, what comments would you make?
That's a very wide question, isn't it? I mean, what do you mean? I mean,
do you feel that it was too, say, shall I say, just for spendthrift, not putting in enough money into areas which would yield money?
Always the belief that deficit financing as such at that stage was going to lead to development. There was no belief that much of the money will find its way into the pockets of various individuals.
For instance, even their planning, I was wondering whether it was comprehensive enough.
No. I was also in the planning.
That was after 53, sir? I mean, before that?
Yes, but it was impossible to do any planning.
A few more queries, if I may, about the mission to London. I was wondering whether Sir Oliver Gunther was present when you went with Sir D.S. Sennait.
He was.
What was Mr. Sennait's plan of campaign?
He was invited by Oliver Stanley, the Conservative Secretary of State of the colonies. And he wanted somebody to go with him. Who can devil find, as it were? He selected me.
Did he participate in your confabulations, in the sense of, say, when you and D.S. Sennait were deciding on how to approach someone, say, did he join?
No, he had no part ever. He might have been present, but no part whatever. But then we got, at the later stage, we got Ivor Jennings, who was present in England at the time, was very helpful to come along and share a room with D.M.D. Silva in his office and work. But he never attended a single meeting with the colonial office. Only myself and D.S. Sennait.
I was wondering what arguments in particular D.S. Sennait presented in order to get complete independence. He must have had one or two...
I mean, he didn't want these three policemen, defense, external affairs and finance to be in charge. He said that complete independence must mean the withdrawal of those people and giving those portfolios to us, to the colonies. And in other words, I mean, he went for dominion status. But Oliver Stanley lost his job immediately after, and we got George Hall instead.
Now, I was wondering whether he had, say, certain points in mind to make, saying that Ceylon had cooperated in the war and things like that?
Worked up, certainly, you see. But it was not a plea. He knew that Britain was going to give India and Burma also almost simultaneously independent, but we thought we might show ourselves to be better boys than they had been and get dominion status before them. Unfortunately, we were only given the Solvary Constitution, which fell short of what we anticipated, although I may tell you how it is. more or less an open secret, that George Hall offered Dominion status one night over dinner, and withdrew it the next day because Ernest Bevin and Kevin Gutley were against it and thought that India and Burma should get divorced.
You, last time, so you described the story of how D.S. at one of these meetings put forward a plea on behalf of the Canadian peasant.
Yes, that's right.
How would that have served his main objective?
I want to show that the minister...